let's take this carefully. First, the musical casserole theory says music matters for diversity because different types of music resonates with different ethnic and racial groups. Okay? In order to diversify a congregation, the music of the congregation must include music of various races or ethnicities, particularly in worship. And music is said to touch the heart and is a way of speaking their heart language. And the congregation as a whole is encouraged to learn songs that may be unfamiliar to them. And I find this particularly interesting in congregations that have begun singing Spanish choruses in their services, even if there are no Hispanics who ever attend. Okay? So, what happens here is the choice of songs matters, but the style matters more. And this is where the literature and the way people talk becomes very interesting. Here's what I generally hear. African Americans are passionate and participatory. They have freedom in musical expression with moving and dancing. And so, this is what you need to incorporate into your services if you hope to have African Americans in your service. How about Hispanics? Hispanics, they're passionate and communal. Dun-dun-dun, brum, you know? And they're upbeat, social, and relational, and quite tactile, with lots of touching, hugging, and holding hands, including the men. All right? I can see a lot of Dutch Reform getting excited about this.
Some of us can.
What are Asians like? What does Asian worship look like? Guess what? I found that Asians are never characterized at all in the literature. So what this tells me is that people have these exaggerated stereotypes about the way people are supposed to worship. And they have them for certain groups of people, but they don't have them for all. And they also tend to lump a great deal of variation and variety into these monolithic groups. Authentic African American. All congregations need to sing such heart-wrenching songs slowly, rhythmically, passionately, in a cappella voices, or accompanied by strong, pulsating piano and or organ arrangements. Music is a vital feature of African American life as a whole, and it often reaches fullest expression for blacks in worship. How about Hispanics? Command of the language is not necessary in order to sing. Even a bumbling attempt at pronunciation of an unfamiliar language shows a willingness to step into the culture and language of another person because of Christian concern and love. A congregation might begin learning a Spanish hymn text slowly, with a soloist or quartet first singing it, and then the congregation. And an exciting hymn to try is Cantemos al Señor, which repeats the opening phrase on each verse and ends with Alleluia. At least such an attempt shows a willingness to try another language, right? These, to me, are expressions of the musical casserole theory. While music itself is not universal, these thinkers assume that the experience of worship is. And the assumption is that even though we don't know how unity is achieved, the assumption is that at some point in time, in the shared worship among all groups, it'll elicit enough appreciation of the others, such as certain songs come to bring a particular unity that's born out of exposure to other cultures and the caring community of interaction within a multiracial framework. Basically, you're trying to accentuate difference in order to create unity, which is sociologically contradictory. So it even argues for the obligation to protect and continue distinct cultural identities through worship music. And so often these writers almost accept a charge to protect and maintain these styles. So cultural identities remain distinct, and differences are highlighted. Even more, it assumes that even fully acculturated races and ethnicities are radically distinct in their responses to music. This is where it gets very, very problematic. The response to music is not culturally learned, but deeply rooted in the essence of persons from a shared racial or ethnic group. In other words, here's a person, you go, oh, well, I see your parents are from Mexico. Well, great. So then that means you're Hispanic, so that means you like salsa music. So then that kind of trail leads a person to go, then the way you would respond best to God is through salsa music, we need to do that. And then he says, well, I just grew up in Van Nuys, you know. This is a person who has never been to Mexico. No? Doesn't go to visit Latin American countries. These are what the literature calls primordialist, essentialist assumptions. This is old ways of thinking, thinking that has been rejected in social science for the last 100 years. Primordialism assumptions is embedded in these beliefs, and they portray a type of anthropology of race. It says that individuals maintain deep affective ties to ancestral culture through early formative years, regardless of their later circumstance, acculturation, or attitude. Now, here's another thing. It assumes that church leaders can definitively isolate distinctive musical spaces between races and groups. And if I could do that, I'd make so much money. I mean, I just go, here's the CD, right? Here's all you need. And people go, okay, great, great, great. And that's what you learn. And this is the conversation that I've had with now quite a few worship pastors. They say, my pastor is telling me we need to become blacker. So then the worship leader goes, okay, what do I need to do? So I guess that means I need to put Negro spirituals. And so then they start doing Negro spirituals. And somehow that's supposed to create a climate in which blacks are going to be somehow more accepted and drawn into this congregation. Does it even sound like it'll work? I mean, it doesn't. But we think it does. But it doesn't. It's very misguided. What it does is it exaggerates the supposed differences between racial groups on the basis of music. Hey, Hispanics like conga drums. Right? With the little whistle. Beep, 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 you know? That's the way you do it. Blacks like gospel, and whites, they like acoustic guitar. One black woman I talked to in a church, she goes, they like vineyard music. You know, so that's what she cares for. So unity occurs as each person waits their turn, while the music of other groups are played and sung. And this polite turn-taking is seen as a necessary experience in order to have unity in the church. All right? So, there is simply no monolithic musical tradition within any racial or ethnic group. Period. C. Michael Hahn insightfully writes, when approaching liturgical plurality from an understanding of musical meaning, one soon realizes there is no universally meaningful musical experience. In other words, people in common sense life, they think this is true. Any person who knows anything about music immediately dismisses it as a naive notion. Musicians already understand this. Musicians immediately go, oh, of course not, you know. And the appreciation and sophistication that comes with actually knowing music will not let you do this. But many pastors, many church leaders, and many sincere people who want to work through issues of diversity don't know this, and instead mistakenly insist on something that simply isn't possible. There are profound differences in musical experience, and it's especially notable in the contemporary black church, an entity that many people unknowingly assume to be monolithic. Jimmy Abington, he presented here, he's a great guy, and he's a professor of music and worship at Candler School of Theology at Emory, and he's an expert on African American worship. He was a part of putting together the African American hymnal, worship hymnal. And he insightfully uses the term multicultural to refer to the differences of musical tastes and styles within the black church. Now, one example, the conflict between hip-hop for younger blacks and Negro spirituals for older blacks is an interesting generational dynamic that's similar to the conflict between rock and roll for younger whites and classic hymns for older whites. Now, this does not summarize all of the conflict. It's just to offer you an insight into some of the complexity that's there. So it's vital that we come to understand that not all members of a particular racial or ethnic group share the same musical tastes or heritage. If you get nothing more from this workshop, that would take you a long way. It takes you a long way towards avoiding what would mistakenly accentuate differences and further expand the gap that exists between your church and the other groups that could potentially fit in. That was theory number one. Theory number two. Theory number two, I call the one-size-fits-all theory. What do you think the one-size-fits-all theory says? In many ways, it's exactly opposite to the musical casserole theory. The one-size-fits-all theory says certain types of music effectively transcend racial and ethnic differences. Okay? Now, what styles of music do you think might be transcendent, shared by all peoples?
All the old Dutch Reformed.
Oh, of course! Of course, all the old Dutch Reformed. My goodness. That was a nice plug. One church musician said it's all about rhythm, okay? Certain rhythms are believed to be universal to humanity and tie into the deep resonance of shared human experience, shared human existence, as if the DNA of people is similarly wired with respect to music. Now, it's connected with the view of music as a universal language that naturally brings people together. Okay? Again, anyone who knows something about music immediately rejects this notion. They know this is not true. The idea of music as a universally transcending racial groups appears more common among members of monoracial than multiracial churches. Because what they're doing is they're thinking, well, we have such a good time, you know, there must be something here. And people who promote musical plurality of the musical casserole theory tend to view their approach as a next step in their personal development of sensitivity. Well, let's go on. Leaders in the one-size-fits-all theory, they consciously commit to one musical genre. That's the trick. That's the key, the clue to see what do they believe about music, if they're intentional. Now, they assume that this music effectively touches all people. Now, here's the irony. The irony is that the particular genre of music being promoted, usually alternative rock, contemporary praise music, or R&B, funk, soul music, is different in each church. Right? You need to catch the irony, right? These people say, this is the music that does it, right? But every church that believes that happens to have a different conviction of what that music is. The belief is universal, the content is not. That creates the problematic. So although the creed music is a universal language is followed, the style of music considered universal is not, in itself, universally shared among multiracial congregations. And here's the thing. The physical presence of racial and ethnic diversity in their church appears to confirm their beliefs, right? They say, of course it works. Look at us. And part of the reason that this happens is because most people who go to church don't go to a lot of churches. They just go to their church. And maybe they visit one or another, so they have no basis of comparison. And so if on the basis of the five churches they've ever been to, four of them were homogeneous and the one was diverse, well then this is what must work in order to make it diverse. So it feels authoritative, but in terms of what is a social scientific research question and what you do for evidence of that, it's insufficient. Right? It's insufficient. So, an interesting twist emerges from Michael Hahn. Michael Hahn sternly criticizes the musical casserole theory as a type of ethnotourism. This is a very nice term. I think he's right. Hahn persuasively argues for the use of polyrhythmic music in a pluriform liturgy. And careful selection of music from other nations collapses for him into what he often labels global music to promote understanding between cultures and the development of ecumenicism among mostly mainline denominations. Now see, whether he intends to or not, Hahn's concept of global music is a type of one-size-fits-all theory. He says that this is the kind of rhythms that will hold people together, and we need to do this. Almost focuses on percussion. Now, here's what he continues on. In practice, Hahn's argument encourages a conscious attempt to minimize westernized Christian music. And he's especially against those that are influenced by market-driven pop music styles. Okay? So it's the idea of let's embrace the world, but let's minimize the West. And the part of the West that he has it out for is, you know, contemporary Christian rock. You know, all of that stuff that feels more like top 40 music than something that he thinks belongs in church. Hahn boldly states that popular music in North America may undermine or contradict the gospel and place churches in danger of cultural captivity. Now listen, assessments like this create a harsh environment for contemporary worship music in North America, right? In favor of the popular music of other peoples, right? The popular music of Africa, Asia, and Latin America is to be preferred over the popular music of North America. And so churches in the United States should eagerly embrace the popular culture of foreign nations, but carefully and consistently resist their own. As a sociologist, I find this problematic. Right? Part of the reason is not because I automatically think that we should all use, you know, contemporary music. That's not what I'm saying. But there is an argument to be made that contemporary styles of music have been effective at stimulating diversity in churches. Why? The reason why is because as immigrants come and their children acculturate, their culture is whatever is on television and radio. In other words, acculturated immigrant children adopt popular American culture. It's what they know. And that means that the music that is Christian music that fits into that style of music is actually closer to their experience, closer to the relevance of what they know and understand, than trying to acculturate them into the popular music of the 18th century. So we have to open our considerations of what that means, because maybe contemporary Christian worship is most effective. Is it? I don't know. Don't let anybody tell you that they know, because they don't. It's just possible. It's just possible. So, I've been sorely tempted throughout to find a way to describe a universal form of music that's acceptable and important to all multiracial churches. Yet I found none. Ethnomusicologists have debated the struggle to find musical universality among world cultures, and they found, however, that there are no universals in music, because people ascribe meaning to the same musical sounds in different ways. It becomes impossible to pose any form of shared musical experience. So since the common musical style cannot provide the explanation for binding people into common fellowship, we have to seek commonality not on the basis of shared meaning, but rather on shared practices in the context of broad frames of social belonging and interaction. Here's what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is that instead of thinking that everyone is going to come to think or experience or feel the same way, that we begin to think of worship as what we're doing together. And that whatever happens in the church in terms of what we're doing, in the moment of doing it, is the practice that is a part of our unity. Now, there are other things to reflect on. Here I'm just trying to focus on worship in the service. I'm trying to talk about music and practice, and I'm trying to find the language to talk about music as practice and not as a set of beliefs or even just experience. Music is an inherent part of church services. Music that is not simply a part of the culture of the church, is not embedded within the culture of the church. Music is a performative element that actively engages the community in its very existence. And so music does not add to the community. It is, in the moment it is done, the community of a congregation as it continues to move forward in life as a whole. Part of what I'm suggesting here is that whatever happens in church is who we are together. And so when we're out here, you know, we're doing different things, but once we step in here, what we do together is a part of how we find unity. And this is a little tricky in terms of trying to really figure out what's going on and how to explain some things. I'll try to give you a story here. Let me just say one thing first. Church leaders believe that the power of music is accomplished through the teaching of the words of the music as well as the practice of singing together. You know, boy, if we can just have meaningful words, then we would actually have something happen. In all of my observations and interviews, it is the practice that is more important than the teaching. It is in the doing of it that we find the power of it. And so worship encompasses the entire liturgical event that occurs within all church services, and it's a structured way in how participants in the church experience church. And so racial and ethnic identity, corporate belonging, occurs in unanticipated ways. This is what I want to tell you a story about. Through the opportunities for interaction made possible through the presence and performance of music. What do I mean by that? There's a woman that invited me into her home as I interviewed her, and she was so sweet to me. And she sang a song. She talked about how she loved being in the choir. The choir was her place. And they have a lot of different songs. They use different hymnals from different denominational traditions. And the choir itself was diverse. It reflected the racial diversity of the church. And so I was like, okay, great, I'm going to go to hear this choir. So the choir sings. Sunday morning. They are off. It's terrible. I mean, really, the piano was off. They weren't all in sync. It wasn't loud, you know, it was just, ooh. So they end. So I started to ask people, and I said, you know, when the choir sings and stuff, you clap. What are you clapping for? Half of the people said, oh, the music's so wonderful, so beautiful. Like, that's just not true. It's so wrong, you know. I didn't believe a word they said, you know. And the other half said, well, they're our choir. And I started to picture, like, you know, that nephew with the violin. You know, it doesn't sound all that good. But, you know, you go, yay, you know, because that's my nephew, you know. And I started to think about music in different ways. I forgot that I was a sociologist, right? I had brought in tape recorders. I was listening. You know, it's almost like I could have conducted my whole study with my eyes closed, just my ears open, you know. And then I go, I've forgotten the fundamental base of what we've studied as sociologists. The embeddedness of social practices and social interaction. What occurs? And I thought, you know, music actually creates spaces of interaction. It creates spaces for us to bond and connect with one another. And the two most important that I learned out of this story is that, one, the unity of this multiracial church was not in the choir singing. That it was all happening in the rehearsals. It was happening in being a part of a particular ministry group. It was in the singing of the birthday, you know, happy birthday, you know. And it's the, you know, being there because somebody's having a hard time. And it's them all visiting so-and-so because they're sick. And it's what's happening because of what the music allows as a base of relationship. And then in the congregation, It wasn't that in the performance we were all lifted to heaven. That wasn't what was happening. It was in the performance there was a sense of connection that you're us, we're you, we're together. And there's this deep sense of commitment that that's us, you know? That's just us. And we're going to love them and support them. God bless them, you know? And I saw that in other places, too. I remember being in another place, and they had, you know, a choir. They had about 8 people, and they'd, you know, get up and kind of do it. They would straggle in. They never practiced. They just picked up the hymnal and just started singing, you know? And they weren't good singers. And in fact, you know, one guy said, they asked me a part of the choir, and I said, you know, I really can't sing. And they kind of said, it really doesn't matter, right? And you know what? It didn't, right? Because it really wasn't about the quality of music. They weren't trying to impress anybody. It was like, this is who we are. You know, we're just going to be together, and this is a group. And so consequently, the best relationships that he had in the church were with other people in the choir. So it starts to give us the sense that when we see music in the wrong way, oh, we need to create a formula that will magically attract people of particular races and ethnicities. Because if we play this music, then they'll hear the rhythm and the vibration and they'll come in, you know. Or they'll hear it and they'll go, oh, this is what I've been just loving, you know. These people are singing in Spanish and they have no clue what they're saying and they don't speak it well. Oh, gosh, I just, you know. That's not what happens. What happens is that music creates a space for people to belong. It creates a space for people to engage. It also creates a space for people to see, oh, there are people of other races, other ethnicities. There are people who are different up there. As it becomes a place where the affirmation of people, regardless of who they are or where they come from, begin to engage in the life of the congregation. And that's what happens. And that's what makes sense to me. So music makes relationships. Because the people I met in multi-ethnic churches talk more about relationships they establish outside of worship than necessarily what happens through worship. And the multicultural diversity in church then is not because of what the choir is singing, it's because of the people involved, the rehearsals, and here's the main point, the community established around the production of music.
That's right.
So, what do we take away from here? I'll give you a few things. First of all, what we need to do is spend less time thinking about what's the right kind of music that we need to play, and more time emphasizing the hospitality of our people. What we mean by that is, I take from the Greek word philoxenos. This is the word that's typically translated hospitality. First Peter, it says, practice hospitality. The Greek word for hospitality is actually a connection of two Greek words. Philo, it's phileo, right? Comes from love. And xenos, which means alien, foreigner, or stranger. So philoxenos literally means the love of the stranger. And what we find consistently in successful multiracial churches is that they create an environment of hospitality to strangers. Now, that's a lot different than just having greeters at the door. They create a place of warmth. One church that I went to, in every service, I found out it happens at every service, but I remember the first time that I was there, all of a sudden at the end of the service, everybody got up, and I didn't know what was going on. So they got up, and they all were holding hands, and so they made a ring around the auditorium, and everybody holding hands. Do you? And it was the first time that I'd seen this, because that holding of hands was very odd and uncomfortable for me, because the pews were staggered like this, and everybody had been facing front the whole time, until this odd kind of reversal at the end, where everybody faces each other, and then they have a song that they sing. And it's like a goodbye song, you know. I don't remember what it is. I may have it on tape somewhere. But, you know, God bless you, and we love you, and, you know, take care of you until we see you again. Kind of a thing, right? And then after that, amen, and hugs.
And it was really neat. I felt like I'd only been there one day, but I felt like I was a part of this community. I totally felt absorbed in this place. From the time that I came in, and Gwen, I still remember Gwen. Gwen met me, and then she connected me with the pastor that I'd already talked with, and then I met with two or three other people, and then I sat down, and I came early enough that two or three people came over and said hello, and then the service, and then at the end, and the hugs, and I'm so glad, and said, come on over. That was it. I mean, I thought, wow, I don't really know a lot about this church, but I could stay in this church for a long time and be very fulfilled. Very fulfilled. Just because of that experience of hospitality. Genuine hospitality is because most people in the world come to a church because a friend invited them, right? And visitors then watch whether and how others at the church treat them, right? Whether they're noticed. You come through the door and people say hello, and not just the official ones who are supposed to greet you. Within these churches, people have a bent to say, we're going to see who's here. We'll take a moment to talk with them and welcome them back. Churches with hospitable attitudes know people need to connect. And the larger the church, the more likely they are to have a welcome area, small groups, specialized staff, and many ministries for people to participate. In other words, lots of places for people to come in and immediately get involved. Immediately. In one church I know, there's a guy who moved from Philadelphia to Los Angeles on a Friday. Somehow he met somebody and connected with them in the dramatic services, and that Sunday, they came on Sunday to church, they connected with people in dramatic worship, and the following Sunday, he was a lead in one of the sketches, one of the dramas. 10 days to assimilate into the core of the ministry of the church. Amazing. I thought it was a record, you know. He didn't have to go to 16 weeks of a membership class. Oh, and by the way, that starts in a month from now. You know, and it wasn't, you know, well, let's check your doctrine and, you know, those kinds of things. It was finding ways for people to connect in ways that made sense, you know, but that they can make a contribution. There's also some basis to say that churches most easily diversify, right, on affinities that are not necessarily based on race. I talked about this more in my other workshop, but there's a sense in which artists are artists, and they like to connect with other artists regardless of what their particular ethnic heritage is. And so they're very good at creating connections between people, and it doesn't have to do with, oh, you're this. You know, we've been wanting to reach people like you. It's not that. It's affinities. And so they attract groups are more culturally distant from each other. Second tip, if you will, encourage humility. Humility is a wonderful and rich word for multiracial churches and those who wish to become diverse. Churches that are best at humility are eager to learn from others. Because the experts for diversity in your church are those newest through the doors, not a committee that's been in your church all their lives. Sometimes I've seen very good-hearted church leaders, and they say, oh, we need to do something. Oh, well, we'll get Betty and Fred and Susan, and oh, we can always count on Jack because he's always part. And these are people who've been a part of the church 10, 12, 15, long time. These people do not know why people are coming through the door. These are your committed people. These may be part of your core. But the experts for what's connecting people now are the people who just got there. And those are the people that you need to listen to, you need to hear. This is, in a sense, playing on what is already happening in your church. You don't have to create something new if you can accentuate what you already have. And so smart leaders get to know those who live near the church. They pay attention to what new people are telling them. And they realize that newcomers' first involvement is simply a bridge to new areas of involvement. In other words, they don't say, oh, you know, I know you'll just have to fit in. You know, they don't try to say, I know you did it that way here, but this is how we do it here. Or no, we don't have that here. You know, it's more of an encouraging, a drawing out of people that these leaders do in these churches. New people become experts. And so rather than saying, oh gosh, they may say that, but we could never do that, or we've never done that before, or something like that. You instead take that as a lead and move forward. Because what keeps people from listening to the newcomer is pride, pure and simple. My church, my way, this is what we do. Humility says, no, no, let's listen to what they're saying. What's going on with them? What would meet their needs? The churches I studied keep expanding their ministries because they create a space for new people in the ongoing mission. Now listen to here's an example for you on the basis of music. Every musician I talked to had gotten involved within 4 weeks of initially visiting the church. Isn't that interesting? All right? But at the same time, every musician that I talked to was involved in their ministry at least a year. Okay? So they had gotten involved within the first 4 weeks, but they stayed. You know, they're very committed. What does that mean? If the average church needs a musician or drummer, then the next musician or drummer through the door gets asked to help out. They get snatched up. But if the slots are filled, then the musician or drummer doesn't get invited. You follow what I'm saying? There is a stream of people who are continually coming to your church. When you have a need, you'll take the newest person if they can fill that need. But after that, the contribution of every other person that comes is ignored. They're just to be a part of the church. Just sit, just be around. No? I'll give you an example from my own church. There's a person who said, I'd really like to be involved, and so I thought maybe I'd just help out on Sunday morning, just greeting. I said, sure, that's great. So I took them over, and I said, so-and-so, who was in charge of the greeting, I said, hey, so-and-so, we got Susan here. Susan's very willing to help. Why don't you plug her in? So, let's say it's Sally. Sally says, great, looks on the sheet, sees that all the slots are filled, and says, well, you know what? We don't really need you today, but maybe you can check back with me next week. Critical error. Right? Oh, this person wasn't trained right. Because it's not about the slots. Right? It's not about the slots. It's not about the administrative organization of the church. What should have happened is she takes Susan and she goes, hey, Susan, come on over. Go, hey, Bob, this is, she's new, and she's kind of learning the ropes, so would you mind kind of showing her around what you're doing? Because you're connecting, making relationships, right? The people who are involved in my church, who are the greeters, you know what they're looking for? They are wonderful people, and I appreciate that they're very warm. You know, I really appreciate that they actually do say hello and meet people. But you know what they're looking for? Looking for friends. And the greeting ministry provides them a base of people. Know them by name, talk with them, they pray every week. It's their community. And so we need to see that everything is an expansion of ministry, and people come in and can potentially create new ministries every week. Somebody says, we had a man come and he goes, do you guys have an alpha ministry? You may know something about alpha ministry. It's a way of reaching out to people who are really questioning God, what to do. It's a series of tapes, it's dinner, it's a lot of stuff. It's basically discipleship. I said, no, we'd love to have it. And sure enough, single-handedly organized everything, purchased all the materials, had it at his house, got 14 people involved right away once we started. And then beyond that, has now a second thing going and new leaders emerging from the group, right? Could have said, we don't do alpha. We got small groups already. I'll take it. I'll take it and I'll run with it. It fits into the mission of our church, and it can expand what we're doing already. So, humility, something that we all need. Think of others as more important than yourself. Philippians 2, right? We need to stop presuming that we know and understand something about a person based on how they look or on an accent, right? We need to stop looking at that aspect of a person and instead try to figure out what's really going on with you. Final tip,
we need to learn how to stimulate creativity in our churches. I would love, on one hand, I mean, my pocketbook could use, if I had the box. Here's my diversity box, right? All you need to do is buy this box. Right? And the box gives you everything you need. It has the sermons, it has the music, it has the sheets, the note sheets, it has the Bible studies. You do this, in 16 weeks, you'll have a diverse church. Okay? Can't do it. Can't do it because if I've learned anything about diversity, it's that we have to appreciate the context of what we're working with, the people that are around us, what's actually happening in our region, who's already attending, what's happening nearby. I can't recommend a specific program for church diversification because each situation is different. And so instead, you have to be creative in your own context. And this is why I'm trying to shake you loose from thinking that there are certain ways that we just all need to do this, and if we just did this and got with the program, it would happen. We need to re-up on our entrepreneurial innovation, our willingness to experiment and explore what would actually help us to connect with the people that we already know. And one of the things, something that I shared in another context, is that sometimes we're short-sighted in thinking that cultural diversity means that we have to reach out to the most different person. And so I've heard of churches that have very interesting ministries for refugees, very, very much the newest immigrants, the ones who are least acculturated, the ones who are the most foreign, if you will, from people in the church. But they ignore the diversity that's happening with people who are much like them. People who live in their neighborhoods, people who are attending the PTA meetings, people who shop in your grocery stores. Because in those places, there is diversity. I'm more likely to stimulate diversity in my church with other parents who may have a different ancestral background than I will if I go to people who don't even speak my language. I'm not saying that this is a bad ministry. Of course it's a great ministry. To do outreach ministries of that sort, to bring them in, to care for them, this is part of what we should be doing. But it is not a strategy for church diversification. And as we are able to expand on people who are much like us, then they can help us to expand to people who are less like us. So I might not be a real good Cuban, but I have more connections to the Hispanic world and Hispanic sensitivities than a lot of my friends who grew up, you know, in North Carolina. That's all they know. And so I have some sensitivity that allows me to be able to take a step. As your ministry expands in that way, then you have a greater possibility of expanding the potential for diversity in your church. Right? So let's not assume that diversity means cultural distance. It doesn't have to be. Many churches that are characterized by racial and ethnic diversity have people who, when you talk to them, are very similar to one another. They actually have similar life contexts. And I talk about these in what I've written. In some cases, it's because of certain passions like artistry or creativity. In others, it's an occupational concern like trying to make it in the Hollywood industry and make a living. But in any way that you look at it, life circumstances can be broad enough that we can find people who are similar to us, and in the texture of their identities, yes, they also have differences in their ethnic and racial heritages. And so we can avoid exaggerating differences and instead tie into people on the basis of things that we already share. Okay. There's a lot more to say, but this is the basics of what I have for you, okay? So within that, I'm happy to answer questions and things. Of course, I wish you well with your ministries. Can I answer any particular issues or questions? Do you have any thoughts or comments? Yes?
I love your comment on encouraging involvement.
Yes.
What if, about the ones where there's already... Ours is half Navajo, half white.
Mm-hmm.
How do you involve?
So they're not involved already? I think, see, this is where I can't answer that for you.
Okay.
But
But I think the fact that you see that and know that is something that you need to address in your ministry. Because I don't think that involving them just on the basis of being Navajo is enough. If they're not involved, then it says something to me about the degree to which they're actually really a part of a common body, you know, common unity, things that you're doing together. And so this is where you need to do that and then call people out as an expression of who we are and what we're doing together as a part of a shared body of Christ. Yeah. So I appreciate your issue, but there's no way that I could answer.
Well, yeah, it did make me think about it.
Yeah.
And so I was just thinking, find what they love.
Sure, absolutely.
But don't love potlucks. Don't approach them as Navajo. Say, hey, we're having a youth group meeting, and invite all the youth, or a women's meeting, or a...
Yeah, but they don't
come.
I understand.
But
understand.
No,
there's something there, and what you may not realize is that the things you're inviting them to may actually have a lot of insider status. You know, there may be a sense that they only see that they're being invited to cross a bridge that they don't want to cross, rather than seeing themselves as a part of something that we're all a part of.
But no one asked the question actually crossing things twice, so never mind.
Very good. No, that's good, and I appreciate it. Great. Yes, ma'am. Or did you have a question?
Maybe it's a question, maybe it's a comment.
Sure.
It seems like to push yourself into that constant state of openness.
Yes.
If you're in charge of music, means accepting a high degree of instability. I mean, it's a frightening proposition because every time that you work with somebody new, you don't know what they're capable of. You don't know what their music vocabulary is. And
you don't know if they'll show up.
That's true.
And that's the reality.
And I'm not complaining. Actually, it's a great challenge.
No.
But it has to be accepted that you're really living dangerously.
Yeah, well, dangerous might be a little... I mean, it's not like Uzi guns or anything like that. But I do think that if your church is running well, you've perfected a machine for a particular way of life. And so... it is true that anytime you try to accommodate for freshness, vitality, and even improvisation, then you need to master a different set of skills. Churches can master those skills, absolutely. It's that we refuse to, or we decide we don't want to. But there are many churches that have vibrant ministries that don't operate like a machine. And so the movement towards improvisation, at the very least, mirrors what a lot of other businesses and corporations are doing today. Moving towards loosely coupled, emphasis on values, being able to have something that we're doing together, and so we're building on that rather than something that's well thought out ahead of time. And so there's a lot of things that are there. I appreciate that you call it a challenge. I'd say that you have to decide. This is what I'm hearing from other people. They're saying this is not just a net challenge, it's that we have to do it. Because if we don't do it, this machine may continue to run well, but it's going to do it with fewer and fewer people. So you have this big, you know, it's sort of like having a Hummer, right? It can hold 10 or 12 people, but this big machine is used only to drive up and down the driveway. Just one person. And so you have this massive machine. So instead, we have to create something that's more nimble, something that's a little bit more responsive, and something that, yes, may cost less or have less, you know, of a package to it. And that has a lot of things. There are people who won't like it. There are people who feel like their way of life is being threatened. There are things that people already like about your church. So it also involves a shift in what your church values. The Mosaic book that I've written deals a lot with that, because Mosaic really focuses a lot on change. And by doing so, it actually says, why are we changing? Is it just for the sake of change? No. Mosaic is very effective, and you can read about how they accomplish it. But the Mosaic in Los Angeles is very good at saying, we are willing to change because we're on mission. And being missional demands responsiveness. And that responsiveness you can't predict because the world changes. And so the wind blows where it will. This is a John 3. And we need to be able to be attentive to where the wind is blowing. And so when we perfect a machine for what God was doing 50 years ago, we're actually ignoring what God is doing today.
Mm-hmm. Very well said.
Well, that's our time. I'm happy to talk more. I wish you well.
Thank you.